ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Mr. Lerman raped Miss Higgins. I hasten to stress this is a finding on the balance of probabilities.
Federal Court Justice Michael Lee's damning finding in Bruce Lerman's defamation action against Channel 10. In a 324-page decision, Justice Lee found that on the balance of probabilities, the former political staffer raped his then colleague Brittany Higgins in Parliament House in 2019. Justice Lee found that Channel 10 could rely on the defence of substantial truth to totally defeat the defamation action, and that Lerman's decision to sue was a grave mistake.
Having escaped the lion's den, Mr. Lerman made the mistake of coming back for his hat.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. On The Law Report, I'm joined by University of Sydney Professor David Rolfe, one of Australia's leading defamation experts. David, what did Justice Lee mean with his statement, quote, escaping the lion's den, he made the mistake of coming back for his hat?
Well, as is well known, Lerman was not convicted in the Supreme Court of the Australian Capital Territory. The criminal trial there for sexual assault was the jury is discharged due to juror misconduct, and the DPP has decided not to pursue another criminal prosecution.
Because of concerns about the mental health of Brittany Higgins?
Because of the concerns, yes, that's right. And so having escaped a criminal conviction, Lerman then put his reputation in issue in civil proceedings to clear his name. And as we've discovered, it's often very a very dangerous thing to do, to put your reputation in issue in these sorts of high-stakes defamation cases.
And what he decided to do was to sue for defamation for a broadcast in February 2021, when Brittany Higgins gave an interview to Channel 10, and specifically to journalist Lisa Wilkinson, where she spoke about being sexually assaulted in Parliament House in 2019 by a colleague who wasn't identified, but Bruce Lerman said, look, he was shunned by a large group of people immediately after this interview. So this was all before she'd gone to police and this criminal trial had actually taken place and not reached a conclusion. So to be clear, the criminal processes where the standard of proof is beyond reasonable doubt was closed when the ACT prosecutors decided not to proceed with a retrial. This is a finding in a civil case, and that standard of proof is on the balance of probabilities, right?
Yes, that's right. So the criminal and civil proceedings do two different things. So the criminal proceedings are concerned with whether he has been proven beyond reasonable doubt to have committed that, with the consequence then that he would have been deprived of his liberty, presumably with a period of imprisonment. A defamation proceeding is a civil proceeding, and so the issue here is whether it is defamatory to say of him that, in essence, he's a rapist. And so the civil standard of proof applies, but as Justice Lee pointed out in his judgment, you have to be satisfied, actually satisfied, that it is established on the balance of probabilities. So it's not a sort of mechanical or sort of mathematical exercise of 51% or something like that, given the seriousness of the allegation. He, as the tribunal, in fact, had to be actually persuaded that it was more probable than not that this allegation was substantially true.
As I stressed at the commencement of these reasons, there is a substantive difference between the criminal and civil standards of proof. To make the grave finding Mr. Lerman raped Ms. Higgins, it's unnecessary for me to reach the level of certainty indispensable for criminal liability.
So at the beginning of his summary, Justice Lee walked through what he thought of the evidence given by each witness, both in the trial and since the allegations first came to light. He described Bruce Lerman as having Walter Mitty imaginings. What other descriptions or assessments of Bruce Lerman stand out for you?
Well, I mean, Justice Lee found that in a number of significant respects, Lerman told deliberate lies in his evidence. And I think that was significant, that his evidence couldn't be relied upon unless it was corroborated by others. And so he had lied about a variety of things, including, or Justice Lee found that he had lied about a variety of things, including spending money at the bar in question and the sources of money that he had available to him on that night. You know, the CCTV footage, which was available, made it clear that Lerman was buying a large number of drinks, but the evidence as to the amount of money that he had in fact spent couldn't possibly have extended to the number of drinks. It's those sorts of things. You know, Justice Lee found that Lerman had denied, had lied about his attraction to Brittany Higgins, for example. So there were just a range of profound ways in which Justice Lee found that Lerman had lied.
I do not think that Mr. Lerman is a compulsive liar, and some of the untruths he told during his evidence may sometimes have been due to carelessness and confusion. But I am satisfied that in important respects he told deliberate lies.
To quote Justice Lee, to remark that Mr. Lerman is a poor witness is an understatement, end of quote. And he also said, quote, Mr. Lerman was hell-bent on having sex with a woman he found attractive, had been mutually kissing and touching, and knew had reduced inhibition. He did not care one way or the other whether Miss Higgins understood or consented to what was going on, end quote. A damning assessment.
Yes.
Justice Lee was also critical, though, of Brittany Higgins. He described her as a complex and unsatisfactory witness. What did he have to say about her reliability, consistency, and truthfulness since first speaking out about what took place in Parliament House?
So, yes, there were also significant criticisms of Higgins's evidence. But I suppose significantly here, Justice Lee tended to deal somewhat differently with evidence around the time of 2019 when the incident occurred and conduct from 2021 onwards when these revelations were made public through the Project interview and the interview with Samantha Maiden. And he was mindful of the need to be sensitive towards the way in which complainants in sexual assault matters might process and take time to process what has happened to them. And so factored that into his credit findings, but also found, and particularly in relation to conduct from 2021 onwards, that even though, as he ultimately concluded, the rape had occurred, that particularly from 2021 onwards, there are a number of instances in which Higgins was not truthful or had been sort of moulding her evidence to fit the narrative that had developed that there was a political cover-up of the rape.
Which Justice Lee didn't accept, did he?
No. And of course, that was what he described as the major motif of the Project story. So really, the judgment sort of separates out the imputation of rape, which is dealt with in relation to the justification defence, and the problem for the statutory qualified privilege defence, which was the sort of fallback defence here, as it turned out.
And that, in layman's terms, is the idea that all the journalistic and ethical boxes had been ticked by Channel 10, but before they broadcast. And because he found substantial truth, he didn't need to go to that second defence, but he wasn't impressed by that second defence.
No, that's correct. So statutory qualified privilege really turns on network tenants and employees, and its employees demonstrated that they acted reasonably in the circumstances of publication. And obviously, where you've got a very serious allegation of rape, you would need to take even more sort of significant steps in terms of, you know, checking the veracity of your sources, the reliability, you know, calling, giving a reasonable time for comment to the person who's the subject of the allegation. And for a range of reasons, although it was obviously not dispositive here, Justice Lee found that that defence would have failed. So had truth not been made out, that fallback defence would have failed.
Damien Carrick here. My guest on the Law Report is Professor David Roth, who is walking us through the damning decision of Justice Michael Lee in Bruce Lerman's spectacularly unsuccessful defamation action against Channel 10.
Given its unexpected detours and the collateral damage it has occasioned, it might be more fitting to describe it as an omni-shambles.
Omni-shambles, indeed. So how did Justice Lee come to the conclusion that there was substantial truth in the program that was broadcast by Channel 10. What did he say about the events leading up to what took place in the ministerial suite?
So Justice Leake goes through the evidence carefully and systematically about what happened on the evening in question, noting, of course, that you had, you know, some contemporaneous sort of evidence that was particularly important. So the CCTV footage of the first bar where they went to. But you also had two very stark and starkly different accounts of what had happened. So you had Higgins' account that she had been sexually assaulted, and Lehrman had denied that he had had any sexual intercourse with Higgins, and in fact that he had essentially gone one way, she'd gone another, and that they didn't see each other again for the rest of the time in Parliament House. And so one of the things that Justice Leake makes very clear is that this was a sort of difficult case in the sense that it clearly turned on findings of credit, and he had a very sort of stark choice between two competing versions of events. And I think also significant in reaching those sorts of conclusions was Justice Leake was not satisfied by the explanations given by Lehrman as to why, having sort of spent a night drinking, he wanted to go back to the office and note up documents in hard copy for question time a week and a half hence, which was one of the versions of events that he gave. And so it was in that way that Justice Leake came to the conclusion that he was comfortably satisfied that sexual intercourse had occurred.
He was also critical of Lisa Wilkinson and Channel 10's senior litigation counsel, Tasha Smithies, for the Logie's acceptance speech given by Lisa Wilkinson, which led to a delay in the criminal trial.
The argument there was that the speech in question raised real concerns about sub judice contempt, given the content of it, which suggested that Higgins, as the complainant, should be believed, and then by implication that Lehrman had, in fact, committed the offence. Broadcast to such a wide audience a short time before the trial, the criminal trial, was about to commence before a jury in the Supreme Court of the ACT, that was arguably a sub judice contempt, and that was something that, if Wilkinson herself didn't know that, certainly, you know, the in-house lawyers should have known and should have been attuned to. And the problem with not identifying that risk in the first place was compounded because in the proceedings themselves, Network 10 witnesses were reluctant to accept that that might have been the implications of that speech.
But whatever those criticisms were, he found in favour of Channel 10 because he found that this broadcast was substantially true. Everything there was substantially true. So there are three elements to rape. What did Justice Leake have to say about these three elements and whether or not Bruce Lehrman had raped Brittany Higgins?
So in relation to this, for the purposes of the defence of justification, he wasn't satisfying himself that some statutory definition of sexual assault had been established. The question was, because the allegation was made in the broadcast of rape, what was the natural and ordinary meaning of that term, and what would the ordinary reasonable reader understand that to mean, and how would they understand that if it were to be made, proven to be substantially true? And so Justice Leake identified that he needed to be satisfied that sexual intercourse had occurred, that Higgins hadn't consented, and that Lehrman knew that Higgins hadn't consented. And so they were the sort of three aspects of substantial truth that Leake had to be satisfied for the defence of justification to be made out.
And he was satisfied in all of those. I think the idea was that Bruce Lehrman did not care whether or not Brittany Higgins was consenting. He was not asking her, and he was not mindful of that.
Yes, so the basis upon which Justice Leake found that Lehrman knew that Higgins did not consent to intercourse was on the basis of recklessness. So he didn't care whether or not she consented.
There had, of course, been a lot of drinking that night.
Yes, there'd been a very substantial amount of drinking that night, which is also the subject of findings by Justice Leake.
I consider it more likely than not, in those early hours, after a long night of conviviality and drinking, and having successfully brought Miss Higgins back to a secluded place is he, Mr. Lohmann was hell-bent on having sex with a woman he A, found sexually attractive, B, had been mutually passionately kissing and touching, C, had encouraged to drink, and D, knew had reduced inhibitions because she was very drunk.
Now, it's important to remember that Brittany Higgins was not a party to these proceedings. This was a battle between Channel 10 and Bruce Lohmann. Yet she's the one who arguably is the biggest winner here, because the criminal justice process was closed to her. It did not deliver an outcome which substantiated her experience. But now there is a finding on the balance of probabilities that recognised what happened to her.
Yes, that's right. And so it's now the case, and Justice Lee is clear about this, that Lehrman committed rape and that Higgins was the victim of a sexual assault, and that that can be said because it's been proven to be substantially true.
Now, the defamation trial was heard late last year, but just before the court was about to hand down its decision, the court reconvened to hear the evidence of a disgruntled Channel 7 producer, Taylor Auerbach, who helped secure an exclusive interview with Bruce Lohmann for the Seven Network, which went to air in 2023. And he told the court, you know, that Channel 7 reimbursed Lohmann for money he spent on cocaine and prostitutes. And perhaps more significantly, and this, of course, attracted a lot of headlines, but perhaps more significantly, Taylor Auerbach also told the court that Bruce Lohmann provided Channel 7 with the contents of the electronic brief from the criminal trial, which included things like CCTV footage and also text communications between Brittany Higgins and various people. What did Justice Lee have to say about that?
Yeah, so for all the sort of, you know, publicity surrounding the sort of late application for reopening and the late admission of evidence and the sort of lurid nature of a lot of that evidence, really what was most important was this aspect of Auerbach's evidence that Lehrman might have breached what's known as the Hearn and Street obligation that parties to proceedings are subject to. And so one of the difficulties here has been that Lehrman has denied that he has been the source of material from the criminal proceedings in the ACT, which have been published in a number of media outlets. So where a party to a proceeding receives information from the other side under compulsory processes of court, they're bound not to use those documents or information for any purpose other than the proceeding. And so what was important in Justice Lee's judgment is arising out of the Auerbach evidence is that he was satisfied that at least some of the information in question was able to be sourced to Lehrman disclosing that to Channel 7.
And Justice Lee, you know, he's a civil judge. He has nothing to do with any criminal prosecution that might arise out of this situation. But he sort of acknowledged that he was comfortably satisfied that Lehrman did breach this obligation.
Yes, that's right.
David, big picture. The last time we spoke was following the verdict in the Ben Robert Smith defamation case, which was another example. That was where the defamation action brought by former SAS soldier Ben Robert Smith. He sued Nine Media for articles that said that he had committed war crimes in Afghanistan. This is another example here where defamation case brought by somebody who's angry about media publications has really exploded in the face of the people who brought the action, who are seeking vindication and compensation for what they described as being defamed.
Yes, so it is another one of those high-stakes, high-profile defamation cases. And as Justice Lee says at the end of the judgment here, Lehrman is not entitled to vindication of his reputation. And in fact, Network 10 is entitled to vindication of their conduct. The problem that I think cases like the Ben Robert Smith case demonstrate in this case is another reminder of this. It's defamation litigation is always risky. You're putting your reputation at issue. You can never control what will come out in court. And we certainly saw that in November and December and even into this month in this piece of litigation. And once you've put your reputation in issue, things can end up going in ways that you don't expect, or in the case of both Ben Robert Smith and Bruce Lehrman can end up very badly for you. I mean, I do also think that it's very interesting here that the defence of justification has succeeded. And so in both of these very high-profile, high-stakes cases, media outlets have been able...
Justification, you mean truth?
Truth, yes. And the benefit of something like truth is that it's either objectively true or it's not. It's either substantially true or it's not. And it doesn't matter what your motive is in publishing, and it doesn't matter whether you acted reasonably or not. Truth is a complete defence, and it's demonstrated to be a very effective defence because, as you can see in this judgment, and we saw it in Ben Robert Smith as well, if it's substantially true, that's really the end of the matter. It's either true or it's not.
True or not true. University of Sydney Professor David Rolfe, one of Australia's leading defamation experts, thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks, Damien.
And if this conversation has raised any distress or concerns for you, we do have a list of contacts for support groups and services on the Law Report website. When is a work of art discrimination? Last week, the Tasmanian Civil and Administrative Tribunal ruled that a ladies' lounge at Hobart's Museum of Old and New Art, known as MONA, discriminates against men. Lawyer Robin Banks was Tasmania's Anti-Discrimination Commissioner from 2010 to 2017. Tell me about it. What do we know about this ladies' lounge? Can you describe it for me?
Well, as I understand it, it's very plush. It's subtle, deep tones of green with gold highlights, very much like an old style or continuing, in fact, men's club, that sort of sense of somberness and a comfort and plushness. That would be a nice place to spend a bit of time. And there are artworks in there.
And what was the thinking behind the ladies' lounge? What was it trying to achieve?
Look, that's a really interesting question because in the judgment there are two quite different versions of the intention. But it seems to me that originally the intention was to promote awareness of the limited access for women to some spaces and also the way in which women's art is underrepresented in galleries across the world. At the end of the day, though, listening or reading the evidence given by the artist herself, Kersha, it was about creating that experience of exclusion from space that the artwork is about from beginning to end almost, I would say. And I think that how you characterise the artwork matters to how you determine whether or not discrimination happened.
So the art was created by, or the room was created by artist Kersha Cashel. She's the wife of David Walsh, who founded MONA. In April last year, New South Wales man Mr. Jason Lau was refused entry into the ladies' lounge, and he lodges a complaint with the state's anti-discrimination tribunal. And very interestingly, like you said, the artist and the museum accept that this is discrimination, or he's losing out, or he's getting less good service.
Yeah. I don't think there's any question that he was treated differently. And in a layperson's understanding, that means discrimination. But I think it's very interesting. Discrimination law is a complex area. And I think there's two ways to think about this piece of art. And the tribunal member has chosen one way. And I think there's another way. So the tribunal member decided that the service that he was being discriminated against in was physical access to the limited space of the ladies' lounge.
The comfy couches the nice atmosphere, warm surrounding atmosphere.
Yeah, absolutely. However, and I think this is Cashel's argument, in fact, the service is probably access to MONA and experiencing the artworks within MONA. And the experience here is the experience of inclusion or exclusion that many women have experienced. So it's offering to people who will never experience it, that experience of exclusion. And then everyone, irrespective of their gender, does have that experience. So there was he had no less experience. In fact, in some ways, he may have had a more vivid experience because he'd not experienced that before.
Greater artistic insights because he was excluded. He was getting the message of the art.
Yeah. So on that argument, there wasn't even unlawful discrimination. So that's the first way in which I think this case is tricky because the tribunal member said, no, what The exclusion was from that particular space. That was on the basis of his gender. End of story.
How does this decision sit with the existence of, say, women-only gyms or men's sheds or women and only men's clubs, the kind of fancy kind that is being mimicked? Yeah.
Well, discrimination laws in Australia tend to have much more specific exceptions or defences for gender related matters. And the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Act has one that permits clubs that are designed for men or for women to be able to maintain that space. I think the question about, say, men's sheds is, you know, are they a club? And they probably are an incorporated association and therefore a club, so they probably fall within that exception. Women's gyms, I think, fall within quite a different sort of understanding, and because it's about making spaces where women feel comfortable to exercise without feeling that they're under scrutiny, that they're not being observed by men who may be watching them for purposes other than to assist them in improving their physical fitness. So there are ways in which all of those sorts of things have been challenged and have been upheld by the law.
So this ladies' lounge, it's a space, but it's also a form of performance art, right? There's somebody at the door and lets you in or says, no, you can't come in, and it's all very nice and they look after you nicely inside the room. When the case was heard, the museum and the artist continued the performance art aspect at the hearing. What did the artist and her supporters do, and how was it received?
Well, on the day, it wasn't received at all. The tribunal member was entirely unaware of it, as were others involved.
Even though it made the news?
Yeah, even though it made the news. So, yes, others observed it, and I suspect that was because of what happened particularly afterwards. So during the hearing, Ms. Cashel was giving evidence and was, you know, clearly sitting in the body of the tribunal, it's my understanding. In the gallery, there was a group of around 20 women who were dressed similarly to her, so in very sombre, dark blue business suits, looking very professional. Throughout the hearing, they apparently sat in the same style. So if one of them had their right leg crossed over their left leg, all of them had their right leg crossed over their left leg. If one turned her head to the right, all of them turned their heads to the right. So there was a little bit of a synchronized swimming type of event going on in the background, which wasn't observed, apparently. And then they left the tribunal in a synchronized manner, leaving the tribunal, walking out in a line to the music of Robert Palmer, Simply Irresistible. I mean, this was part of the performance. I don't want to put words into the mouth of the artist, but it seems to me the decision is part of the performance and any appeal will be part of the performance. You know, it is really art doing what art does, which is to try and hold a spotlight up to the world and say, you know, this is how I see the world. I want you to understand my experience of the world and give you an opportunity to see the world differently to how you might otherwise.
Lawyer Robin Banks, Tasmania's Anti-Discrimination Commissioner from 2010 to 2017. Thanks for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks, Damien. Great to have the opportunity.
That's all we have time for today. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.